You guys should open up to Psalm 73 if you want to read along, or if you just trust that I'm actually reading the Bible and not making it up, you don't have to. You know, sometimes I think we forget how great a salvation we actually have. Right? I know sometimes for me, if I come to church, and you're thinking about 15 different things that are going on in church. Is this the cafe closing early enough? Are people here in time? Is like the reading of the word at the beginning accomplishing what it's supposed to? Like the vision behind it, everyone's hearts are connecting and pointing towards God. You're doing all this stuff. And then you're trying to worship. And there's 15 other things in your personal life. And you're just like, oh, I could just be going and setting that table up now instead of waiting until after church to do it. And really taking for granted the fact that God is present in our midst, because I'm so blinded to such a real and evident truth by just familiarity, right? Been walking with God for over 30 years, so it feels very normal life. This is just life. I don't really remember what life was like before that. I mean, I have memories, but it's not me. I think I'm thinking of a different person when I remember those times. But to think that God, in his perfect holiness, in his goodness, in his graciousness, in his justice, in his righteousness, looks at us, even on our best days, filthy rags, right? But just think of yourself not on your best day. Think of yourself when you get caught up in unbelief, complaining, gossiping, griping, less than loving each other. That in these times, every one of us, that, and this is the mind-blowing part, that is enough to deserve hell. Those things alone are enough to deserve hell. We don't have to go murder somebody or do any things that we would consider atrocious. Anything that violates the holiness of God, who he is, to be present with him in that place, deserves hell. Yet, because he loves us, he looks at that, demonstrates his grace, and has offered us such a great salvation. It's like we can easily forget how great a salvation we've actually been given. How do I know that? Because we actually complain about anything. Complaining about anything is a surefire sign that you have forgotten how great a salvation it is that you have received. And this is the worst part. We oftentimes complain about things that two-thirds of the world would kill to have. So hot in here. I can't believe the air condition's only working at 50%. Where does our tithe go? Does it even go anywhere? They don't have the money to repair the air conditioning. Meanwhile, there's like half the world is walking 14 miles in 110 degree heat just to show up to a dirt pit to worship together. We have such a great salvation. And that's not, I'm not saying, oh, we're so much worse than them. No, they have their own sins and their own faults. I'm just saying the things we tend to complain about are someone else's treasure. And so the fact that we even find within ourselves a complaint should be a real warning sign that we have forgotten just how far he's taken us out of that kingdom of darkness that we were trapped in and brought us into this marvelous light. And then we end up sounding like the Israelites who were rescued out of Egypt and provided for in a wilderness supernaturally, and they began to complain about the supernatural food that they were getting because they had gotten too used to it. They had taken it for granted. It had become the norm. So they forgot how great a provision was actually happening. The fact that in a desert, supernatural food was showing up on the ground every morning for them and their children to eat, They didn't have to worry about taking care of the children, their family, where's the next food coming from. God supernaturally provided it every morning, and they got so used to that that they woke up complaining and grumbling because they didn't have something different to eat. We have far too great a salvation. Now, I want to go somewhere with that based on Psalm 73. I'm working from my phone today because my computer just decided to not cooperate all morning. I wanted to start with an encouragement. I know that wasn't it, but we'll do exhortation and then encouragement. I heard this really cool story, and it resonated with me because it's something I'm always trying to do when I'm thinking of encouraging people and the good work. And, you know, we just had the work day, and we were encouraging people, and we were, you know, recognizing people for the hard work they do. And, you know, there's so many of us that do that, but there's some particular that stand out above the rest. And then there's those quiet things that don't get recognition. Never mind from the pulpit, even just we don't recognize them as kingdom things. And so I was reading this story. There was this guy, like after 19-something, 20s, 30s, somewhere around there. His name was Mordecai Ham. Anyone ever heard that name before? Mordecai Ham? Raise your hand just so I can see if you've actually heard the name. We got two people, Mordecai Ham. This guy was a tent revival preacher in the early 1900s. So he went around preaching fire and brimstone and salvation, and people getting saved, tent revivals. And so there's a story about these two 16-year-old kids who were walking by during one of his messages, and they heard the music. There was like, you know, revival tent music, worship going on. And so they came in to check it out, and they walked in, and they were looking for seats, but the place was packed, as tent revivals would be during that day, right? Packed. They couldn't find any seats, so they turned around to leave, and they walked out of the tent. And this usher guy, no one knows his name, no matter where you search, no one knows who it was, what his name was, went rushing out after them, saw them turn around and leave, and went out and said, "Hey, guys, come here, you want to come in? We'll find you seats." He came in, and he looked, and he pushed people down, and he found two spots for them to sit together. And those two kids sat there, ended up going up during the altar call, gave their lives to Jesus. So the cool part of the story is this, that one of those 16-year-old kids was Billy Graham. And the other kid was his friend who became Billy Graham's lifelong right-hand man for all his ministry. And they both answered the altar call, both got saved. Because an usher, who no one will know his name till we get to heaven, cared enough about two random teenagers to come and experience what he believed could be life-changing, turned out to be life-changing, and therefore from there, Billy Graham comes, and Billy Graham changes the nation. Like that. That is what we're talking about when we say building the kingdom, when we talk about having a vision for everything we do. When we're coming and we're serving at the church and you're working on the property, this is what God does. This is what I'm saying. Do everything as if unto God, filled with faith, with a vision for what God's doing and what he could do. We're doing the around the sign and we make it look beautiful. That might be the one thing that catches a person's eye. When they come in and they say, "Oh, what is this? Look at this. Wow, this church. Let me check it out." I don't know. I'm just telling you, I'm making stuff up, right? Top of my head. But these things happen. There are people who actually care about stuff like that, right? People who are drawn to things like that, and they get saved in the next Billy Graham. That to me is super encouraging. It says, hey, you might not have a clue about the fruit of what you're doing produces, but God promises us this. That whatever we do in faith, as if unto God, will be rewarded, will produce fruit, will produce what the kingdom says it will produce, because God is in it. Faith pleases God. God responds. He uses all things. So that to me was like, wow, that's rock star status, right? It makes you think like, hey, everything in me wants to be able to meet this usher guy and tell him how awesome he is, right? And that's how I feel right now in this broken, fallen, dying tent that's going to perish soon. But in eternity, free from all these restrictions, it gives you a taste of what glory is going to be like, what the rewards of heaven will be like for those who have chosen to live for that audience of one, pleasing to God, and that's it. Serving, laying their lives down quietly in their prayer closet where people may or may not see, they may or may not recognize, they may or may not praise you for it, but God is seeing, and you are tilling the ground in your heart and the ground saying, Lord, this is for you. This is for you. Use it. You're soaking it in prayer. You're soaking it in faith-filled efforts, and it produces. And this is the story of everyone and anyone who's ever made an impact on the world. It's the common thread throughout it. So, that was the encouragement. Keep doing what we're doing, guys, serving God in every way possible. Mother Teresa once said this, if you want to change the world, go home and love your family. Think about the principle and the essence behind that. You want to change the world? Start by going home and loving your family. And as a Christian, that's revelatory, right? It's revelatory in the sense that this is at the heart of the gospel, is that the church is a family of families. And so the health of a church depends on the health of the family. And the health of the family depends on parents who love each other or people who love the Lord first and demonstrate that to their family, loving well. Go home and love your family. We might interpret that as go home and give hugs and kisses to your family. Sure, that's a small part of it. But loving your family well, that means sacrificing, laying down, demonstrating, being an example, pushing, leading, correcting, disciplining. And you do that, and you might raise a Billy Graham, right? Or you might raise an usher who changes the world. So, really cool. Let me read Psalm 73. I'm going to read the whole psalm. I know I'm challenging this generation's attention span by doing that, but I think we can do it by the power of the Holy Spirit. Right here, Bruce. This is how. Psalm 73. Listen to this psalm. God is indeed good to Israel, to the pure in heart. But as for me, my feet almost slipped. My steps nearly went astray, for I envied the arrogant. What? This guy envied the arrogant. This is what he's saying. Listen to what he's saying and relate to it. Think about how many times in our lives we've looked at other people who seem so successful and it's so easy and they have so much and they don't seem to struggle, yet we're like fighting tooth and nail to pay our bills and get by. Then my steps nearly went astray, for I envied the arrogant. I saw the prosperity of the wicked. They have an easy time until they die and their bodies are well fed. They are not in trouble like others. They're not afflicted like most people. Therefore, pride is their necklace. Uh-oh is right. And violence covers them like a garment. Their eyes bulge out from fatness. The imaginations of their hearts run wild. They mock and they speak maliciously. They arrogantly threaten oppression. They set their mouths against heaven, and their tongues strut across the earth. Therefore, his people turn to them, meaning God's people, turn to them and drink in their overflowing waters. They say, how can God know? Does the Most High know everything? Look at them, the wicked. They are always at ease, and they keep increasing their wealth. Did I purify my heart and wash my hands in innocence for nothing? Because I'm afflicted all day long and punished every morning. But if I had decided to say these things out loud, I would have betrayed your people, God. And when I tried to understand all of this, it seemed hopeless. That's easy to relate to. Am I going to grind and struggle till I die, Lord? Is this what it's going to be like? Again, I think this is part of him getting caught up in what he says at the beginning, right? He envied the arrogant. He's diagnosing, he's telling us there was envy involved. What we talked about right at the beginning, that we look and we complain about the things we have because it's not enough, because we're comparing ourselves to something else. And we find ourselves envying. And that envying manifests in complaint, which then breeds unbelief. And unbelief is a death sentence. And this is where he's at, and he's communicating this. This is what happened. So when I tried to understand all this, it seemed hopeless. There was no understanding. How is this even possible, God? How could you be good if your people struggle while the wicked are the billionaires? Just a wrong standard we use to judge success and stuff, because envy comes in and then complaining and unbelief. But the next verse starts with the word until. Until. That's what I titled the message, until. He says this, until I entered God's sanctuary. Then, only then, I understood their destiny. There's this transformation that takes place right here at this moment. Remember, he just told us he's struggling. He does not understand. He's falling into envy and discouragement. He tried his hardest to understand all this, and it was hopeless. He even says, if I had voice, the only reason why I didn't communicate my frustration and my complaint, my unbelief, the reason why I didn't go on saying this out loud is because it would have betrayed your people. As a leader, you know that feeling. You wrestle with these things and you're like, I can't say that out loud. I can't let people think I'm thinking that or feeling this way. My job's to be an example and to lead. So there's only one reason why I'm not saying it. It's for that. I don't want to betray your truth and your word. He's communicating these things. And it all seemed hopeless until I entered God's sanctuary, and then I understood their destiny. What happens when you enter God's sanctuary? What is the transforming thing that happens there? It's not a building. It's not his location. It's him present. He was there. And when you look up to him and you see him, truth is all that remains. Every false perspective and idea just falls away. It can't stand in his presence. The lies have no power there. The deception and the arrogance and the envy, they have no strength. There's no allure left to them when you are in his presence. When you stand in where he dwells and you're looking at him and you're suddenly having truth itself just full on blasted on you. And you're like, wow, was I a fool? I see clearly now. I can see. He said, then I understood their destiny, and that changed everything. It didn't matter if they had $1 trillion. None of it was worth it in exchange for what their destiny was. Indeed, you put them in slippery places. You make them fall into ruin. How suddenly they become a desolation. They come to an end, swept away by terrors, like one walking from a dream. Lord, when arising, you will despise their image. When I became embittered and my innermost being was wounded, this is him self-describing how he was before this sanctuary encounter. When I had become embittered, scary place, and my innermost being was wounded, I was a fool and didn't understand. I was an unthinking animal toward you. Yet, I am always with you. You hold my right hand, and you guide me with your counsel. And afterwards, you will take me up in glory. This is conclusion. So here's his response to his conclusion. Who do I have in heaven but you? He's responding to his former envying. He's responding now. Truth has reshaped the things he was complaining about, and now he has been reoriented to truth after seeing him, and now he's declaring what he has recognized as truth. Wealth, easy life, lack of conflict. All the things that he thought were so valuable have now been exposed as utterly worthless. And he's saying, who do I have in heaven but you? And I desire nothing on earth but you either. My flesh and my heart may fail, but you are the strength of my heart, and you're my portion forever. Those far from you will certainly perish, and you destroy all who are unfaithful to you. But as for me, your nearness is my good. Your nearness is my good. I have made the Lord God my refuge, so I can tell about all you do. This is just such a great psalm. It's raw. It's honest, it's relatable, and then it casts strong hope, a real vision for the type of transformation God has for us. This is what the New Testament author has in mind, what Paul says when he says, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to the Lord. Don't be conformed to this world, where you might envy and think that what they have is the goal, but rather be transformed. And he doesn't leave it there. He tells us how. By the renewing of your mind. This transformation happened for him when he walked into the presence of God, and the truth that he saw there transformed the way he thought. It transformed his mind. He was no longer being conformed to this world as he was slowly slipping into that, and instead was transformed as his mind was renewed. And in that moment, he was able to then discern what was the good and right and perfect will of God. And when he had that, he then was able to recognize, wait, all these things I've been chasing and pursuing, who do I have in heaven but you? What do I even have on earth besides you? I don't care if my flesh, my body, and my heart fails. I can see now that you're the very strength of my heart, and you're my portion forever. You're my reward. You're the reason why I endure all the things I just painted as a negative. I now see them as a positive. What happened? He tells us here, but what we see happening in just practical terms and in application-wise, this. He now had vision. He had a vision of God, and now he has vision. He can see clearly. And that vision transformed everything he was complaining about into purposeful things in his life. Before he had a vision for it, it was terrible, complaining, negatives. I can't believe I'm suffering. How long is this going to last? None of it makes sense. I'm so envious of these people. He then was given a vision, and now all his pain and suffering became purposeful. This is what it means when we say vision gives pain its purpose. When you have a vision, you're willing to endure suffering and pain because you have a vision of what it's building and moving towards. When you don't, it's just painful and frustrating and produces complaining, envying of the people who aren't suffering, and then unbelief. This is why the Bible tells us that, says, my people perish for lack of vision. He doubles down on that a little bit later. He says, my people also perish for a lack of knowledge. Funny, when I think of these two verses, I always think vision statement, mission statement. Right? His people were perishing for a lack of a vision statement and a mission statement for their life. But when we think about it this way, this idea that vision gives pain its purpose impacts everything, but nothing more so than our prayer life. When you look at this moment, this until moment, what happened? He entered God's presence. That's what happened. This is one of the primary functions of prayer. This is our source. This is our prayer life. This is where we renew our mind. This is where we go and get our feet washed. This is where we reconnect with our source, the one who renews our mind for us. Do you understand? This is prayer when we come into it. Yet, it's such a lacking thing in the church and in Christians. It's wild. When you look at the Barna surveys, there's like less than 5% of pastors, never mind churchgoers, of leaders of churches who tell you they have a consistent prayer life. That's wild. And if that's the leaders, that's the examples, those are the shepherds, what are they shepherding their people in? Prayer probably isn't a priority if it's not a priority in their life. It's like what I tell parents all the time when you're raising children, right? You need to have a vision for their life. Otherwise, your discipline is useless. You don't even know what you're disciplining them to. What? Morality? Even the heathens do that. But when you're disciplining your kids without a vision, what are you doing? You're just trying to shape their behavior. It's behavior modification. It's frustration ending things, right? What you're doing is bothering me. It's frustrating me, so I'm going to discipline you. And that produces, don't bother your parents. Don't do things that frustrate your parents because you'll make them mad and then they'll discipline you. And you know that certainly causes you to learn the love of the Father, right? Not at all. It's the opposite. It's why so many people believe God is a taskmaster. Why they believe works matters in the sense of earning God's favor and love. Because that's how we've raised our children. To think that their behavior is what dictates our love for them. Because we discipline without vision for who we want them to become. And then if we have that vision, every act of discipline is operating in service of that vision and pushing and shaping them towards who we want them to be and who we want them to see. Our prayer life is no different. If we don't have a vision for our prayer life, why are we going to do it? Because of church discipline? Because of the Christian disciplines? In order to be a good Christian, I got to make sure I get my 26 and a half minutes of prayer in each day. What does that sustain? Legalism? Works? Earning the favor of the Father? It's identical. It looks the same. The reason why our prayer lives look like that is because that's what the rest of our lives look like, because we don't really understand the value of the vision. Of having a vision. Understand? When people get burnt out, oftentimes it's lack of the vision. They lose sight of the vision and the source of that vision. And other times, there's all sorts of reasons, but I'm saying that's one of the primary ones. Vision gives pain its purpose. You recognize why you're suffering and who you're suffering with and who's with you in it. So in prayer, this is really hard. I started saying, yeah, it is really hard. Even though I know what I want to happen happens so infrequently, it gets frustrating. I want to be able to sit down with the Lord and feel a real connection and like I'm making progress in my relationship with God and I'm hearing from Him and I'm being led and the Word's coming alive, but sometimes it just feels like reading, right? And sometimes it just feels like I'm asking my question list. Or even sometimes like I'm begging God to do something that my head says, but you want to do this more than me. Why isn't it happening then? If I were you, it'd be done already. It's just because our prayer life doesn't start with this vision that all these frustrations and questions will exist until we enter in. And here's one of the practicalities of it. We will never get there if we don't first show up. If we don't first show up, that will never happen. Tyler Stanton, in his book, he says, praying like monks, living like fools. It was a really cool book on prayer, right? And he makes a statement that was really resounding. He said, hey, prayer starts with presence. And this is a guy who's been praying like as his primary ministry since he was in eighth grade. He's the national director for the United States of the global 24/7 prayer movement. And so this is like his life. And he said, prayer starts with presence. And I was like, man, and I had been reading Psalm 73 over and over when I was reading the book. And he's like, this is resonating, like exactly. This is what I'm reading. These are putting words to the feelings I've been feeling as I've been meditating on Psalm 73. This idea that showing up is where prayer starts. And it's really practical. Now, when I first heard it, I was like, oh, prayer starts with presence. Yeah, with God's presence. But that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about your presence. Saying prayer starts with you being present, with you showing up. With you saying, I'm here, God, I am not doing all the other things, I'm here doing this one thing. I'm present, and I want to meet with you, and I want to spend time with you, and I want to hear from you, and I want to learn from you, and I want to be guided by you and corrected by you, and I want to love you, and I want to be loved by you. And I also want to talk to you about all the things you've put on my plate. And I want to talk about the responsibilities that you've given me and the people you've given me and my children, God. Are you going to do this? I need you to do this because nothing I do works. I can't do it. I'm just me. You're you. And this is prayer, but it starts by showing up. And I was like, yeah, that's logical. But if you listen to the heart of it, it becomes impactful. Prayer starts by you being present. Anyone here have adult children? Raise your hand if you have adult children. Now, hopefully you all relate to this. You're not a bad parent if you don't. When your adult kids, right, want to spend time with you, right, they have to make efforts now, right? Life's busy, they're busy, you're busy. But when they want to spend time with you, they show up. They make it a point to show up. And just showing up speaks volumes. That's it. It doesn't mean if they show up and then they get distracted easily by their kids or by their work or their text, phone calls, things, whatever, like their life. They're living their life, but in the middle of life, they decided to show up. They get distracted, you know, like, oh my God, why'd you even come? You're so distracted. Nope. You're just sitting there like, hey, they came. This is really cool. Oh, and then you're waiting for the distraction to go over, and then you're like, oh, let's connect. What are you talking? What's going on in your life? How can I help? Yeah, I'd love to help. This is great. That's what it means to just show up. And God is our Father. That's how he's chosen to identify himself to us. He's done that on purpose because he knows what Father means to us as humans. He could have chosen anything. He could have chosen to reveal himself as the supreme emperor of the galaxy. But then how would we relate to him like that? Probably in fear and, you know, offering sacrifices. Instead, he said, hey, I'm your Father. I love it when you show up, when you're present to be with me. And you know what? When you draw near to me, I will immediately come and draw near to you. I'll reschedule, I'll rearrange, I'll do whatever. And that's, I'm using human language. God doesn't have to do any of that. But my point is, like, you draw near to me, I'm going to draw near to you. You show up, I'm going to show up. Now, when you show up and you're distracted, of course our time's not going to be as connecting, as meaningful, but it's still time. We were still together. My presence will still have an impact on your life. This will still be time spent together, which is what transforms us. The less you're distracted, the better. The more you can focus, the more intimate and experiential your time will be. But let's not worry about those details. Let's start with showing up, being present, letting prayer call us to a present place and location. And this is why it's so important to have that time. In the morning, at night, in the middle of the day, lunch break, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's when you do it, that's what matters. There's a real effort, there's a desire that's there, right? When we show up, it's because we want to meet with God. We want to meet with God because we understand our great need for Him, and then hopefully also we have a love for Him. And we want to know Him more. We want to get to know Him more. We want to understand Him more. And so because of that, we're like, hey, God has told me all about Himself in His Word. And so I'm going to open up my Word. I'm going to show up, be present, open up my Word, and I'm going to read some of the Word. And I'm going to talk to Him about it. It's one of the best ways to stay focused. Because you have His revelation right here. God, I want to talk. You wrote this letter to me. I'm so glad we're here together, face to face. But look, you said this. How should this be transforming my life? Like, what am I seeing? Show me some insight here. Or you read Psalm 73 and you're like, I relate to this. It resonates in my heart. Who do I have in heaven but you? You are my portion forever. It's true, God. Your nearness is the definition of good for me. When you're not near, all these other things I used to think were good are not good in comparison. I really feel this. Your nearness to me is my good. In a real practical application, I think I might have shared this before, but I went through a season recently where I really thought I was going to die any day. I thought my heart was dying on me. I was did all the tests. I did every single test you could do short of the one where they go up your, like, groin veins into your heart. I was like, I'm good. I passed every other test. That's enough. The doctor said, you're really fine. I don't know. I said, well, then how do you explain all the stuff I'm feeling? How do you explain me almost passing out and doing all these things that I'm feeling? He was like, are you stressed a lot? I was like, stress doesn't do that to me. He's like, it might be. And then, like, anxiety attacks. I'm 48. I've never had an anxiety attack. I mean, true, I had it 40. This was a 2-year period. Started at like 46. But never, and I mean carried the weight of the world is what I felt like my life, and never anxiety attack was for weak people. And then, I still think it's for weak people. I just recognize I'm a weak person. It's true. I'm saying that not for humor, but for truth. It was humbling, and I recognized another level of my dependency and need for God in my life. That when I am weak, if I trust Him, then He can make me strong. And these anxiety attacks, which were like paralyzing, I mean paralyzing. Melanie thought I was going crazy. I in no way, shape, or form planned on harming myself. But the way things were going, she was fearing for that. Never entered my mind. But she was like, I did want to check out of life. And I didn't know what to do with it. And the whole time, I thought God was disciplining me. That's how I understood what was happening in me. The fear of the panic attack, the anxiety, I was understanding as God crushing me. Like trying to squeeze out every last ounce of like repentance or sin or anything I had in me. And I mean, I was like in my bed with Melanie praying for me, and I'm just like trying to think of every single little thing I've ever done that I could possibly say. I'm like confessing stealing like Twizzlers when I was 9 and different, everything I could think of. because I was interpreting a natural thing, a bodily function, as the only way I understood it, which was spiritual. And it wasn't. All that to say this, it demonstrated to me my weakness on another level. And in that time of thinking my heart was failing, and now this would cause, if you've ever had anxiety attacks, you know, it's like your heart. You're like, oh, it's back again. I'm going to die of a heart attack. And then no matter how many times the doctors told me that all your tests are fine, like you look okay, you're, you could be more in shape, but you're okay, it didn't matter because what I was experiencing was right here. And I had all sorts of really good people giving me good advice and all that stuff, but none of it mattered. You know what changed my life? Desperate prayer time where I read Psalm 73. Because I was asking the Lord to save me. I'm like, you need to do something. And I was reading a verse, and I read it in context, but the Lord spoke to me through it out of context. Because that's what being present with God does. It allows God to speak to you, directly to your heart. Now, I'm not going to go and teach the world that that's what the verse means, because it doesn't mean that in general. But God, through his Spirit, spoke it to me specifically. And he used this to bounce off of. You see the difference? If you take something that God speaks to you, that's kind of out of context, but he's speaking to your heart, and you teach it as if it's God's revealed truth, you become Joseph Smith or another cult leader. That's how cults start, right? We don't get to change the word, but God gets to speak to us personally as a father. And in this, when I was reading this, I was like, I was thinking along the lines of this when I was reading it. I was like, yeah, you know what? I was like preparing my internal will, essentially. I'm like praying for my kids. I'm like, God, you need to be their father. If I'm dead from this and I'm gone, like I'm entrusting all of them to you to raise them, to know you. It's incomplete work, God. I haven't had time to finish it, so I'm trusting you to do it. I knew Melanie was all taken care of. We've done all that. I got the life insurance policy, praying for her, like that she would never find anyone else to marry. Going through that, but like in not such extreme terms, but I was saying like, God, I'm going to trust you in this. Because I kept saying, yeah, God, I have no one in heaven but you and nothing on earth, but that's not what I'm worried about. If I had none of those concerns, I'd be like, take me now. Like, just let me go. But anxiety is an irrational fear. Your body like hijacks your thinking. And so, as I was reading this, and I read, my flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart. And I know that's talking about, in the context of this person, him saying, like, it doesn't matter if I die, because you're my reward. And that's how I was reading it. But on this time through, I read it as God speaking to me, saying, hey, Steve, even if your flesh and your heart fails, don't worry, I'm the strength of your heart. I got it in my hand. If your heart fails, I'm going to keep it going until I'm done. And I mean, that was the type of imagery I had in my mind. I saw him, my heart, in his hand, failing, like stopping on its own strength, and him saying, like, yeah, this is where I take over. And just, he's pumping my heart. And I was like, okay, all of it may fail, but you're the strength of my heart, not my muscle. So, okay, I got it. My heart is indestructible until you say so. And I haven't had an ounce of anxiety since. Over it. Nothing. It's when it happens, I'm like, yeah, okay, I get it. Something's got me stressed or working up. Or if I feel like, oh no, this feels like the beginning of an anxiety attack, I'm just like, it doesn't matter. God is the strength of my heart. And that truth has literally staved off lies and corruption and death. So this all started, though, right at the same time as I was reading, praying like monks, living like fools, Psalm 73, meditating. And what I was doing when I was doing this was showing up. I've been showing up much more consistently over the last year. And it was these anxiety things that provoked that. It caused me to see my weakness and recognize my need. And then all the weight of the thing, the stress that's coming, recognize, like, if I don't have your source in a new way, in a way I've never had before, this is all going to crush me. So I have the choice, quit or go get some supernatural strength. And before, it was just like, why is this happening? None of it. But until I began to enter his sanctuary, then everything starts to make sense. Now this life is what it is, and God is sovereign, and he's leading us, and he provides. So lastly, to wrap this up on prayer, it's showing up. And then I started to say, God, I think I talked about this a few months back. Feels like it could have been a few months back. Might have been a year or two. I don't know. I don't do well with time. But this idea that, man, what is the point of praying any single idea I have if the only valid prayer is, let your will be done, right? That's a logical approach, and it feels very reasonable when you say it. God, my prayer is, I don't know, what's your will? Just do your will. What do you want to do? Just do it. Here, my prayer is like cheerleading for you. Do your will. Do your will. I'm here because you told me to be here, to pray with you because you said pray. So here's my prayer. What do you want to do? Yeah, do it. Do that. I don't know what it is. You didn't tell me, but do it. It seems like a good idea. And then I read all these other things where Jesus is praying, and it's like, God, and I literally said this, God, please teach me how to pray. Teach me how to pray. And then I remembered, and I'm not lying, I'm not making this up just for dramatic effect, I remembered, it came into my mind, this exact question was asked in the Bible by his followers. So I started meditating on the Lord's Prayer. Looking up, reading, and this is something I've learned about the Lord's Prayer, is that the disciples were not saying, we don't know how to pray. They were raised with all their Jewish prayers, all the prayers you read in the Old Testament that they said, the formal prayers, the feast prayers, their daily prayers. They were raised to pray when they woke up, for their meals, when they go to bed, all these official, structured, formal prayers. Literally repeating the same prayer their whole life. And one of the things that they did when rabbis would come and take on their new students that they were going to train, they would teach them the rabbi's prayer. The rabbi would teach them how to pray the way he prayed, so the way he would formulate his structures, and they would have set prayers. And so that was one of the ways you could know whose disciple belonged to which rabbi. When they prayed, you're like, oh, they're from Shimei, right? Or they're from Obadiah. Whatever it was, whatever their name was, they would pray. So they come to Jesus and they, Jesus, like John the Baptist and his followers, they pray. He taught them, can you teach us how to pray? Because Jesus hadn't done it. And so in this place, he says, hey, listen, I want you to know, like people think they're heard for their many words. They think that if they just repeat their prayers over and over and they pray in the public, in the marketplace, like, none of that is prayer. It's like when you pray, go into your secret place. What is it? He's saying when you pray, I want you to show up with God, just him. Be present with him. And don't think that when you get there, you're going to be heard because you have so many words and you just repeat the same things. He says, I want to tell you a secret. Your Father knows everything you need before you ask. He's not asking you to pray so you can inform him of anything. He doesn't need you. He doesn't need any information you have. He doesn't need any insight. He doesn't need to hear your request a certain amount of times. What he desires is just for you to be present, for you to show up, for you to want to be with him, for you to draw near to him. And that is an act of faith and recognition that glorifies him and thrills him. And so then he shows up and he says, oh, I love being, tell me what you need. He already knows. This is the secret Jesus is telling. He already knows. So then, why the Lord's Prayer? Jesus said, when you pray prayer like this, give us today our daily bread. But right before that, he already told them, your Father knows what you need before you even ask. Is he just trying to make them feel dumb? Hey, he knows what you need, but ask him anyway. Right? No. He's saying, like, this is what relational interaction looks like. This is what father-son interaction looks like. Show up, be present, and recognize him for who he is and his source. And then everything you ask of him in my name will be given to you. This is the power of the Lord's Prayer. Recognize first that he is your Father and that he's holy. That means set apart from everything sinful. He is set apart from you. You and him are not the same. Father, you're my Father. You're holy. I recognize all this and I worship you for it. Let your name be glorified as holy. Let your kingdom come to earth here, now, as it is in heaven. And God, above everything else, let your will be what's done. Not mine. Let my will die, but let your will be done on earth, right here, in my life, just the same way it's done in heaven. No conflict, no obstacles. Just let your kingdom come and rule in my life, right here where I am, in my prayer closet with you. And let your will be done right here in my life where I'm with you and in my family's life. Then he says, give us today what we need for the day. This is recognizing that he's the source of our provision. You've already recognized who he is. You've glorified him as holy. You've worshiped him. You've shared your joint will with him that you want his kingdom and his will to be done. Now he's saying, now recognize him as your Father. For what son who comes to his father and asks for bread will be given a stone? None. So he says, come and in faith, ask your Father. Recognize that today, for this day, give me everything I need for your kingdom to come and your will to be done in my life. So today we probably wouldn't be asking for bread. It's still very relevant because we're asking for what we need. What's my daily bread? I need your word in me. I need your spirit active and alive, changing me. I need your truth perspective so that I don't envy the wicked, but rather see their fate and recognize that I have no one in heaven but you and no one on earth beside you, that you are my portion forever and your nearness is my good. That's what give us today our daily bread means for us. I trust you, God. You will not lead me into temptation, and you will deliver me from evil. You've already promised this, that when I am tempted, you have provided a way of escape for me. This is here. Do not lead me into temptation, but deliver me from evil. God, I know the depth of things I've been forgiven for. Help me to forgive others in the same way that you've forgiven me. Help me to love in the same way that I've been loved. Help me to recognize the great salvation I've received, the horrible things I've been forgiven of, so that I can freely forgive 70 times 7 as necessary. And God, I ask all of this because I know that yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Like, that's the structure of the prayer. He was telling his disciples, hey, forget about your daily chants. That's not where the power is. The power is in this, recognizing who God is, who you are to him, and what the mission is. How to love well as you've been loved. This has transformed my prayer life. I've recently had my kids memorizing the Lord's Prayer and rewriting it in their own words. Right? Saying, how do you talk to God? Write out the Lord's Prayer in modern Talon interpretation, right? Modern Ashland interpretation. Working through it. I would do it with Liana too, but she's one of those ones that's like the adult living her own life everywhere. You know, if she just shows up once in a while, you're just happy. But that's what it looks like to send your kids out. They have their own relationship with God and they have to live it. And she just finished redemptive history for the third time, so no worries there. But what I want us to know is this. Psalm 73, read it, and then learn to be present so that we can first let him know, I'm here with you, and then he comes. This will begin to change your life, your family's life, but specifically the church's life. Now imagine everyone in this room begins to really put the proper emphasis on our prayer lives. Some of you do, so don't get me wrong. And we did. And then we came together, and all of us from that place began to pray together. What would that be like? If God shows up for that many people at the same time who are praying the way God has taught us to pray in harmony like that, in the book of Acts, they give us a couple examples of what may or may not happen. At one point, the building they were praying in shook. What purpose did that serve? Nothing except to recognize, hey, I want you to know above and beyond you early church, I'm here. I have shown up. I am present with you in the same way. Anyway, my heart is really this. I know and sense a real need for us to connect with God in a greater way and to learn how to pray in a more powerful way, in a more significant way. In a way that connects us with the heart of God. That's what I mean by powerful and significant. I don't mean like anything other than this. Your prayers will be powerful when you recognize you're present with the Father. They become more significant when you get into his presence and recognize I'm changing as a result of this. And then that gets put on display. You become a walking demonstration of those who have been with Jesus. That's wild, right? That's what the church's reputation is supposed to be. So, with that, let's just stand up and begin to pray some. Pray as the Holy Spirit leads you, maybe with a particular focus on, Lord, bring me deeper in prayer. Lord, teach me how to pray the way you want me to pray. Teach me how to connect with you. Teach me how to be the demonstration of relationship with you that you have for us. Worship is a great vehicle into prayer as well. It brings our attention to the Father. But prayer is still us interacting and communicating with God, as he said. Your will be done and your kingdom come here on earth as it is in heaven. This right here on earth first. And then from this springs a fountain of living water. Just begin to pray. No prayer concert, just a whole bunch of people talking to their Father.